although this has been true of every week we've been studying, there are just a huge number of really great poems in this week, and also Monday before vacation starts, and poets who lots of really great poets. So what we're going to do today is we're going to do fairly quickly the Garden of Proserpine, which we started talking about on Monday, and then move on to Hopkins. What I gave you are two poems by Hopkins that are not in this book. You may have done Hopkins before. He's sometimes done in high school classes or just general poetry classes, and he's pretty amazing. So we'll at least talk about a few of his poems, and I'll give you I'll tell you a little bit about him. And then, you know, there's lots of great reading for Monday as well. So much to do. Okay, so let's go look at the Garden of Proserpine. And remember that we have a kind of context for it in the passage from Paradise Lost that I gave out on Monday about that fair field of Anna. So it's page 389. That fair field of Anna, where Proserpine gathering flowers herself, a fairer flower by gloomy Dis was gathered, which gave Ceres, who's her mother. Do people know the myth of Persephone or Proserpine? Quick summary.
Hades, I'm just going to use the Greek names. Hades, the god of the underworld, abducts Persephone, the daughter of Demeter, who is...
also known as Ceres.
Yes, goddess of the harvest, to be his wife in the underworld, and Demeter doesn't like that. She doesn't know initially where, Persephone is. And she goes to Zeus about it, and it's like a whole thing. And she's trying to get her daughter back, but Persephone has eaten like seven seeds of the pomegranate,
which we've talked about a couple of times.
Yep, the food of the dead. Yep, and so she can't fully leave the underworld. So they essentially broker a deal where half the time she's in the underworld, and the other half of the year she's with her mother. And when she's with her mother, the earth is happy, and we have summer and harvest, and all these, the world is alive and happy because Demeter is, and then the other, when it's winter, she's in the underworld.
Right. So, lots of great. That was really well done. Lots of Greek and Roman myths, lots of myths in general in all cultures. The myth is an explanation for the origin of natural phenomena. So Kipling, who we'll be doing later, has Just So stories, which are kind of parodies of those myths. But the myth of the serpent in the Garden of Eden and eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge is a myth about how we become sexual beings, about the discovery of sexuality in one's own life, for example. Presumably there was once a pillar of salt somewhere in the area of what's now called the Middle East, and the myth of how it got there was it was the wife of Lot who turned back and looked when she shouldn't have, and therefore turned into a pillar of salt. So you get the myth of Narcissus is, where does that flower come from? It was once a boy who fell in love with his own image and couldn't pull away, and then pined away, although not literally pined because it's a flower, not a pine, pined away and became that flower, and then Echo pined away because she was in love with Narcissus. Do people know this, the myth of Echo and Narcissus? Echo fell in love with Narcissus. Echo was already punished with not being able to say anything on her own, but only able to repeat what other people said. But then Echo becomes only a voice because she too pines away when she sees Narcissus pining away. So lots and lots of stories. The story of Persephone or Proserpine Persephone, the Greek name, Proserpine, the Latin name, is how we got seasons. Milton tells a story of how we got seasons, which is different, which is that God got pissed off at Adam and Eve for eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge and made the orbit of the world no longer circular. That was part of the punishment that we have undergone. But it's a story of where seasons come from. And interestingly, the standard understanding is, yes, that's why summer is nice and winter is bleak. In fact, in Greece, it was the opposite. It was why summer is so hot and dry and awful, and why what we call winter, that is the months after the autumnal equinox, why they're so pleasant as they are in Greece. But the idea is that Ceres, the goddess of grain and of harvest, is in mourning when her daughter is away in the underworld, and when her daughter is back up in our world, then things are nicer. So the garden of Proserpine is like is what Milton and also Ovid, he gets this from Ovid, and what Spenser called the fair field of Enna. So what's happening is she's gathering flowers, and Hades or Dis takes her to hell. And that's a terrible moment. So here is a poem about that garden by Swinburne. Let's see. I'm not sure what to say. There's an H in Cahill. How would that be?
Sure.
Okay, start.
It's in the middle of my last name.
I know, but what can I do? can anyone make a case for anyone else? 3, 2, 1, yeah?
It's in the middle of my first name.
No, did we decide? Oh, we decided you were going to be, but you were M. You were M last time. Yeah. Have you seen the movie M? Okay, well, it's a great movie. We did it in film noir. Okay.
How much of it?
Just the first stanza.
Okay. Here, where the world is quiet, here, where all trouble seems dead winds and spent waves riot in doubtful dreams of dreams, I watch the green fields growing for reaping folk and sowing, for harvest time and mowing, the sleepy world of streams.
Okay, so who's the speaker? In this garden? Here at this?
Is it Demeter?
I don't think it's clear yet.
Yeah, okay. But who's your guess?
I don't know.
Who would you guess?
Probably
Uh-huh. Okay, so.
I mean, it's her garden.
Yeah. And here is a garden where what's nice about it?
It's all nice. Moral,
yeah, but also maybe a little bit, it's a halfway world. Mm-hmm. Look at the word dead. Here, where all trouble seems dead winds and spent waves riot in doubtful dreams of dreams. So all the trouble of the real world here, the trouble is a riot, which would mean that it's energetic and chaotic, except that it really isn't, because the winds have died, the waves are spent. And it's all of that is something that occurs in doubtful dreams of dreams. The green field is growing. That's great. For reaping folk and sowing, for folk that are reaping and sowing, doing everything that has to do. Reaping is, remember the lines from Spenser, there's continual spring and harvest there, continual, both meeting at one time. So same idea here, reaping and sowing at the same time. Anyone know the famous biblical verse? Yes, or that's the summary of the verse. You reap what you sow. harvest time and mowing a sleepy world of streams. Okay, rhyme scheme. Wait, A, B, A, C? Yeah, A, B, A, B, C, 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 B. So all the stanzas will have that rhyme scheme. Rhyme schemes are really, really important to Swinburne. Swinburne is like Tennyson, only more so. Actually, when Tennyson died, Swinburne had this amazing response where he said, "Now I am king of the cats." He was the last great, he saw himself as the last great Victorian poet still standing. But that's much later than this. Swinburne, as I say, is just obsessed with the musicality of verse. When we get to Hopkins, we're going to be seeing something quite different from Swinburne. So that's the rhyme scheme all the way through. Next stanza, laughter, weep, hereafter, reap, hours, flowers, powers, sleep. It's more than that, though, which is, what's the difference, which you may or may not know, and if you don't know, you may hear nevertheless. What's the difference between rhymes like quiet with riot on the one hand, and on the same hand, still staying on the one hand, growing, sowing, mowing, and rhymes like seams, dreams, and streams? Do you know what the difference is called between those feet, let's call them? Yeah.
Is this an I rhyme versus a V rhyme?
No, these are all real rhymes. Swinburne was not an I rhyme kind of guy. I rhyme kind guy. That's pretty good. But there is another difference. You can hear it in laughter, weep, hereafter, reap, hours, flowers, powers, sleep.
Syllables?
What about them?
Some have two and the other ones have one.
Yeah. So they have what are called feminine endings. So what if anyone know what a feminine ending is? Yeah.
Unstressed at the end.
Right.
Also can be sometimes an extra syllable.
Yeah.
In a line.
Yeah. But it's essentially when you're doing stress, some lines, let's say of iambic pentameter, but we're going to move way away from iambic pentameter today. But some lines of iambic pentameter will end with a stress. I've been considering how I might compare this prison where I live unto the world. So compare ends with a stress, unto the world ends with a stress. But if you say, I've been considering how I might compare this prison where I live unto an auto, which would be a weird thing to do, but still, then there's an extra syllable at the end of the line, which doesn't ruin the iambic pentameter. It is just part of how our brains process meter, is that a feminine ending, as it's called, is just an unstressed ending at the end of a line, which nevertheless, so iambic pentameter is, if you were as strict as you can possibly be, it's going to be 10 syllables long. That is, it's 5 feet. Each foot is an iamb. And an iamb is da-da. It's a word like compare or insane or outdo. So you're going to have 5 of those, and 5 times 2 is, 10. So 10 syllables. But you can add an 11th syllable at the end of a line, which tells you that line endings are a place where the mind kind of the reader and of the poet, regathers a little bit of force in order to get to the next line. So ends of lines have the quality of a breath, something that you're taught in high school, which you should be taught and then you have to be untaught, is that if there isn't punctuation at the end of a line, don't pause. Actually, you should pause just less, a lot less, but line endings matter and you should be registering them. If iambic pentameter, we talked about this a little bit before, but if iambic pentameter is written out as prose, the feel is very different, even though it's the same words. And the question of enjambment, remember we talked about this when we were doing My Last Duchess, the question of enjambment still comes up, but in prose it's gone. So you're supposed to notice the end of a line, and the end of a line is like a pause for getting ready for the next line. And you can have an unstressed syllable there. You can even have two. And those are called feminine endings. So here what we have is here where the world is quiet. Such a good word for a feminine ending. Why? See, now I'm just going to ask why. Why is that such a good word for a feminine ending? Or why is it so good that that word has a feminine ending in this line?
It's self-reflective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. Here where the world is mute wouldn't be quite as mute or wouldn't be quite as quiet as quiet is. So here where the world is quiet, here where all trouble seems, dead winds and spent waves riot, in doubtful dreams of dreams I watch the green field growing for reaping folk and sowing. For harvest time and mowing. All of that is, all of those lines give you a sense of gradualism and then a sleepy world of streams. And part of the question you can ask yourself is, so which is, in a stanza like that, which is dominant? The and dominant is the wrong word, but which is the atmosphere that it really gives you? Is it that the feminine endings kind of lull even the masculine endings into that sense of quiet? Or do the masculine endings interrupt the quietness of the feminine endings? So it's a question of feeling and something that you should open yourself to feel. Okay, so in the second stanza, Sophia, can you read it?
May come hereafter for men that sow to reap. I am weary of days and hours, blown buds of barren flowers, desires and dreams and powers, and everything but sleep.
Okay, so how is she feeling?
Tired.
Okay, good. Yeah, weary. She is no longer energetic, as perhaps she once was. That's why she likes to be this place where the world is quiet. Okay, same rhyme scheme. What about the pattern of masculine and feminine endings? Laughter. Is that masculine or feminine ending?
Feminine.
Yeah.
It's the same pattern as the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, feminine, masculine, feminine, masculine, feminine, 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 masculine. So it's not only a rhyme scheme, but it is a foot scheme. Last foot of the line is feminine, masculine, feminine, masculine, feminine, 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 masculine. So which feels like it's providing the context for the other here? Just a way of repeating the question I asked about the first stanza. Do you feel, let's say that the feminine endings are the quiet ones, are the ones that tend to lull us into quietness, and the masculine endings might be the ones that are attempting to break through that with a kind of abruptness. So which one, what's the tone? What's the feeling? What's the atmosphere? Which ones are feel like they're actually giving the atmosphere to these stanzas, to this poem. Yeah?
I think it's the feminine endings because, like, of where that... I think it's the three in the row that make me inclined to say that the feminine endings have more power over it, but I still think that the masculine endings are successful in just, like, permeating kind of this whole, because the stanzas are ending on masculine endings.
Uh-huh.
So if you're, like, comparing that with, even though it's, like, followed by three, and even though it started by a feminine ending, I don't think the feminine endings are entirely successful in, like, lulling us entirely into the state of sleep.
Okay. What do other people think?
I agree.
Okay. All right, I think it's, at any rate, be alert to the effect of this interplay of masculine and feminine, and just see how it goes. Samantha.
Here life is death for neighbor, and far from eye or ear, when waves and wet winds labor, weak ships and spirits steer, they drive adrift and wither, they wot not who may tither. But no such winds blow hither, and no such things are here.
Okay, so again, we're at this liminal space, this borderline place. That's where the garden is, right at the border. Life has death for its neighbor. And all of the dead winds and the spent waves are rioting far away now, far from eye or ear, the wan waves and the wet winds labor, and the weak ships and the weak spirits steer. Kind of a zeugma. Remember what a zeugma is? Yes.
Using, it's when one word refers to two different parts of speech.
Yeah. Or is used in, it can be the same part of speech, but used in two different ways. Weak ships and spirits steer. So the ships are steering weakly, and the spirits are as well. But it would be a different kind of steering, a somewhat different kind of steering. They drive adrift and wither. They wot not who make thither. This is a little bit hard to parse, so just to see. They drive adrift, and they wot not whither they are going, the ones who are coming there. But no such winds blow hither, and no such things grow here. So they don't know where they're going. Those who are going to those places, they don't know where they're going, and the winds are not blowing anyone here, and there's no growth of such things here. Yeah, I think we have to speed up. Right.
No growth of moor or coppice, no heather flower or vine, but bloomless buds of poppies, green grapes of proserpine, pale beds of blowing rushes where no leaf blooms or blushes, save this whereon she crushes for dead men deadly wine.
Okay, so the only thing that you can find here are grapes that belong to Proserpine. So this is the garden that she has created, and which is a garden of some kind of temptation to a half-life. Where she crushes for dead men deadly wine. Irina.
Pale without name or number in fruitless fields of corn, they bow themselves in slumber all night till light is born. And like a soul belated in heaven and hell unmated, by cloud and mist abated, comes out of darkness morn.
Okay, so here the dead men are bowing, slumbering, and drinking her wine in these fruitless fields of corn. Why? Because Ceres is not growing the grain. Corn there, as you know, means wheat, not corn. They're just there all night. And morning may come, but it is abated with cloud and mist. Yeah.
Could we see the previous stanza as instead of the wine being made of grapes, made out of pomegranate?
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to say the grapes of Proserpine is pomegranate, yeah. That would be a neat description of what pomegranate is in the context of the myth. Yeah, nice. Quinn.
The one where strong is seven, he too with death shall dwell, nor wait with wings in heaven, nor weep for pains in hell. The one where fair as roses, his beauty clouds and closes, and well though love reposes, in the end it is not love.
Yeah, so everything fades away. You could think here, as Swinburne is probably thinking here, of the Lotus Eaters. Remember doing the Lotus Eaters early on in the course, where they come upon the melancholy Lotus Eaters song. So it's the same kind of deadly lullaby, you could say. This is a place where the difference between sleep and death, or the difference between life and death, is just being erased. Okay, Leon.
Pale beyond porch and portal, crowned with calm leaves she stands, who gathers all things mortal with cold immortal hands. Her languid lips are sweeter than love's who fears to greet her, to men that mix and meter from many times and lands.
Great. So, death is sweeter than love. So remember how in the passage that we were looking at last time about going down to the great green mother and lover of men, the sea, what you see over and over again in Swinburne is an exposition, you could say, of what Freud is going to call the death instinct. So do people know that term, the death drive or the death instinct? So it's an idea of Freud's. There are ways to make it arguably true even in contemporary psychology, but you don't need to. It's rather, you could call it an aesthetic description, which Freud claimed was true of all living beings, but that part doesn't matter. But what Freud basically says is there are two great drives that motivate human action. And he calls them eros and thanatos, that is love and death. And love is mainly, that is sexual desire, is mainly what motivates us. Once we have enough food and shelter and so on, everything we do out of some element of sexual energy. We want to look cool to people. We want to seem charismatic to them. All our motivations are ultimately sexual, says Freud, early on. But then later he decided, no, there's another motivation, which is a desire to die. And for him, the desire to die is an extremely paradoxical one, because the question is, why would that be? And the basic answer is that death is rest, that therefore what we want to do is return to that state of rest. But the problem is death is also violence. And so returning to that state of rest is not an easy thing to do, because the whole point is that it should be rest. So the way to do it is to do it gradually as possible. So Freud basically says all things die because all things want to die. All living things want to die. They also want to have sex. At least all sexual beings want to have sex. And these two things come into conflict with each other. The desire for love, for sex, for sexual energy, and the desire to die. But he says all things want to die as well. And the great book that he writes this in is a book called Beyond the Pleasure Principle, where the pleasure principle is the idea that you do everything for pleasure, which is to say, out of sexual energy. Beyond the Pleasure Principle is this book where he's saying, but there's this other thing that seems to be going on. And the desire to die, says Freud, is one which is really difficult to get your mind around, really difficult to give an exposition of. But a good exposition of it is in Swinburne. That is the idea of rejoining, and this is what Jung actually picks up from Freud and really goes wild with. Yeah. But the idea of just rejoining a kind of immersive totality where you lose all individuality, that it felt to be the death instinct or the death drive. That's something that Swinburne is just really, really, really good at giving you a sense of. So the desire to return to the sea, to see death as mother, so that dying is a kind of return to the womb. That's what you'll see all the time, or most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time in Swinburne. And here you can feel it, Proserpine is bringing us there into that melancholy lotus eater's state. And even if you are full of energy, even if love reposes well, even if all of that is true, eventually, well, though love reposes, in the end, it is not well. And when you dwell with death, even if you're strong as seven, you dwell with death, you won't wake with wings in heaven. That's not death. That's eternal life. Nor weep for pains in hell. That's not death either. That's a bad eternal life, but it's eternal life if you go to hell. But this is something quite different. One background for this, I'm sure you'll all remember from book one of The Faerie Queen, is the amazing temptation that despair gives to the knight who undertakes the quest that book one of The Faerie Queen is about. And again, this is a place that Spencer is really important to Swinburne, but what despair is a figure who is attempting to make and almost succeeds in making the knight who undertakes the quest in book one of The Faerie Queen despair. And what he says, actually I should just read it to you. I think Swinburne was obsessed with it. The problem is I'm not going to be able to spell it right. What am I doing? I'm looking at the wrong thing. Oh, search. Okay. Okay. No, I don't want a summary. Okay, this is it. Oh crap! I always do this. It always when I search for something, I get to schmoop, which is not helpful to me. All right, let's go back. Oh, this should do. Okay, yeah, here we go. Okay, so what despair is saying is, then do no further go, no further stray, But here lie down, and to thy rest betake, the ill to prevent that life ensue and may, that is, that may ensue in life. For what hath life that may it loved make, and gives not rather cause it to forsake? Fear, sickness, age, loss, labor, sorrow, strife, pain, hunger, cold, that makes the heart to quake, and ever fickle fortune rageth rife, all which in thousands mo do make a loathsome life. Thou wretched man of death hast greatest need, if in true balance thou wilt weigh thy state, for never knight the dared warlike deed more luckless disadventures did a mate. And he goes through some of the things that went wrong for Red Cross, and then he says, why then dost thou, O man of sin, desire to draw thy days forth to their last degree? Is not the measure of thy sinful hire high heaped up with huge iniquity against the day of wrath to burden thee? I'm going to skip another thing he did wrong. Is not he just that all this doth behold from highest heaven and bears an equal eye? Shall he thy sins up in his knowledge fold and guilty be of thine impiety? Is not his law, let every sinner die? Die shall all flesh. What then must needs be done? Is it not better to do willingly than linger till the glass be all outrun? Death is the end of woes. Die soon, O fairy's son. So that's the temptation of despair to the knight of Book One of the Fairy Queen. Death is the end of woes. Die soon, O fairy's son. And what Spencer is doing, what Swinburne is loving, is that last phrase, O fairy's son. It's like, here's this wonderful fairy tale place where you can simply die in peace. And that's the temptation. Leon? It's your turn, right?
No, I think you just did it.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Where did we leave off?
She waits.
Okay, that's what I thought. She waits for each and other. She waits for all men born. Forgets the earth, her mother, the life of fruits and corn. And spring and seed and swallow take wing for her and follow where summer's song rings hollow and flowers are put to scorn.
Okay, so she's just waiting for everyone, and everything will come there. Okay, I'll do the next one. There go the loves that wither, the old loves with wearier wings, and all dead years draw thither, and all disastrous things. Dead dreams of days forsaken, blind buds that snows have shaken, wild leaves that winds have taken, red strays of ruined springs. All those things go to that garden. Eileen?
We are not sure of sorrow, and joy was never sure. Today will die tomorrow. Time stoops to no man's lure. And love, grown faint and fretful, with lips but half regretful, sighs, and with eyes forgetful, weeps that no loves endure.
Okay, so that's a pretty amazing stanza, just to notice it. We're not sure of sorrow, not sure of joy, not sure of anything. And so love is only half regretful as it weeps that loves don't endure. It's not, oh no, it's so awful that love doesn't endure, and therefore that shows my passion, that I feel so terrible that passion doesn't endure. No, love weeps, but even that weeping is part of the lulling of the poem. Sophia.
From too much love of living, from hope and fear set free, we thank with brief thanksgiving, whatever gods may be, that no life lives forever, that dead men rise up never, that even the weariest river winds somewhere safe to see.
Great. And just you are noticing, right, that it's the always the same alternation of feminine and masculine endings. Every stanza has the same stress scheme. Not only the same rhyme scheme, but the same stress scheme. So we thank whatever gods may be, because gods don't even matter anymore. But to the extent that we are thanking them, we thank them that no life lives forever, that even the weariest river winds somewhere safe to see. So that's this poem's version. Here it's a metaphor of I will go down to the great green mother, mother and lover of men, the sea. Okay, Samantha.
Then star nor sun shall waken, nor any change of light, nor sound of water shaken, nor any sound or sight, nor wintry leaves, nor vernal, nor days, nor things,
diurnal. Which means daily.
Only the sea is eternal in an eternal night.
Great. So it's a poem of temptation, like Despair's. But the person who's tempted is Swinburne. That is, he's tempting and he's tempted. And he's tempted by really what is, it's kind of death's lullaby, you could call it. It's just the way things lull you into the sleep eternal in an eternal night. That's what he does over and over again in his poetry. He does other stuff, but that's what is most characteristic of Swinburne. And just to get back to Freud for a minute, Freud sees, so just to say a little bit more about the death instinct and why, whatever truth or falsity there is in it, why it is a good reading of a certain kind of poetry, is that Freud came up with the idea of the death instinct by trying to understand what he called repetition. So what happened was in the First World War, which is well after this, which is 50 years later, Freud, the psychoanalyst, was trying to understand what we would now call PTSD. That is to say, and what back then was called shell shock, which is that people who had survived traumatic stress kept reliving that moment of trauma. And they would be hospitalized and people would try to calm them down and say, look, you're safe now, and so on. But they couldn't stop themselves from reliving it. And this was repetitively, constantly. And for Freud, this was terrible, but also a huge puzzle for his psychoanalytic theory, which is a theory that Oscar Wilde kind of mocks beforehand, but also agrees with, which is in, how many people have read The Importance of Being Earnest?
It's so good.
Don't take my word for
it.
Take Julia's word.
It's so good.
So there's one point in The Importance of Being Earnest where one character says to another, what brings you here? And what makes you come here? And his answer is, what makes anyone do anything? Pleasure, of course, which is to say that all human motivation is a motivation to increase pleasure and decrease unpleasure. Anything you do, therefore, Wilde is going to say, but he's following what a lot of 19th century psychologists say, you do for pleasure. Why are you scratching your ear? Because I have an itch and it gives me pleasure to make that itch go away. Everything you do, all human motivation is pleasure. So why did you talk under torture? Because if I didn't talk, I would have less pleasure than having the pleasure of having them torture me less. So that's Freud's theory. Everything is done for pleasure, where the heart of pleasure is sexual desire. But everything is just some modality of a pleasure that you see in its most prominent or purest form in sexual desire, or in the pleasure that sexual desire desires. The idea of repeating those traumatic moments in the trenches, in shell shock, of going over them again and again and again in your mind and waking up screaming and not being able to get away from them, it was really hard to see people repeating those experiences as being motivated by pleasure. Just the worst possible experiences, why do you keep repeating them? Is there any way to make that, describe that in terms of this univocal theory of motivation, which is pleasure? Almost a tautological theory of motivation, which is pleasure. But what possible pleasure does what motivates PTSD? That's what he's asking. What motivates someone to do that? What motivates a certain kind of obsessive, and then his word is repetition. And he gives an answer, which is actually a really good one and is probably true, and which we won't go over here. But in the course of giving that answer, he starts thinking about repetition and why there is any kind of repetitive behavior. And the basic idea is that repetition is the sign of the death instinct. And if that doesn't make sense to you, and if his explanation of that, which is we want to repeat the world, the non-experience in which we started, our pre-conceptual experience, not only our prenatal, but our pre-conceptual experience, we want to repeat that. So repetition is a way of getting back to where we started. And that, for Freud, is the death instinct. But he then just focuses on the very experience of repetition. And what Swinburne can help you with in reading Freud, or maybe what Freud can help you with in reading Swinburne, is to see that those repetitions are things that are occurring through rhymes. That is, that the repetitions of these rhymes, especially the triple rhymes in the 5th, 6th, and 7th line of each stanza, has that kind of lulling effect which Swinburne is associating with death, and with death as simply a place of non-differentiation. And so what happens is differentiation is evaporating. Differentiation is eroding away into this oceanic, which is what Jung is going to call it, this oceanic sense of merging with death. And Jung is getting that, I don't know how consciously, but he's getting that from Swinburne, going down to the great green mother, mother and lover of men, the sea. That's the oceanic feeling. But the way it happens in Swinburne is through rhyming. So we looked at the intense rhyming that you get in Goblin Market. And that rhyming is sexual rhyming. It's just more and more and more. Here you get a different kind of rhyming, which is, they're both seductive. The Goblin Market rhyming and the Swinburnian rhyming, both of them are really seductive. But the seductions of Swinburne's rhyme is a seduction into undifferentiation. And that is what Swinburne is always obsessed with. Okay, so now let us move to Hopkins, who is totally different.
I was going to say, that's the transition that's interesting with the poems that you chose.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
is that another poem on the next page, or is that
part
of the same poem?
It's
a different poem, right?
You mean Why Grudge Them Lotus Leaf and Laurel?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a different poem.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it may as well be the same poem, but yeah, it's a different poem. Okay, so let's go to Hopkins, and let me just... Do people know anything about him? Had you read Hopkins before this class? No one? You had? Anyone else? Pied Beauty is... I think that's the first Hopkins that I ever read. We did that in high school. Just take a look at that just to give a sense of what a lot of people take to be typical Hopkins. Pied there means something like dappled. That is like when you talk about a piebald horse. It means that it's dappled in various ways. So here's a poem of praise. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow. So skies that are not simply one color, but couple color. What's so great about the term couple color? Why is that such a great term for what it's describing?
It alliterates.
It alliterates, and...
He's talking about multiplicity, and he's mirroring it in his language.
Yeah, here's a couple of words that alliterate, and that are slant rhymes. Couple color. So skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. Glory to God for all of that. Much happier poem than Vincy Poplar's. All things counter, original, spare, strange. So glory be to God for everything, all the originality, all the differentiation in the world. So Swinburne is about ending differentiation. Hopkins is about celebrating it. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Such a great set of words, if you think about it. All things counter, that is all things that oppose. All things that are counter to some kind of unification. All things counter, all things that are original, not simply one of the mass. Spare, not simply falling in, floating in with the totality. Strange. Glory be to God for whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim. He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. So who's that he?
God.
Yeah, quite the opposite of death. He fathers forth all those things, just all the unbelievable variety of the world. So Swinburne, you don't get pied beauty. What you get is completely uniform, lulling beauty. In Hopkins, you get the opposite. So, Julia, what do you know about Hopkins biographically?
So, he was from a well-off, artistically inclined family in England, and he went to Oxford, where he got involved with the Oxford movement. And he was one of the members who ended up taking it to the point of converting to Roman Catholicism.
Right.
He ended up
and we've talked about this a little bit in some other poems.
He ended up becoming a Jesuit priest. He was in communication with Newman to a great extent.
Right. So remember Lead Kindly Light, Cardinal Newman?
Yes. So we'll get
you
there
read
soon.
Yeah.
He had a lot of... he was a really strange person, a very interesting person. He had, like, from a very, like, early age, like, he had these philosophies of, like, poetry and art and this theory that's based out of... This theory of aesthetics that's also kind of based on how he saw the world as, like... He belonged, like, scholasticism and this idea of, like... that everything like has an essence that is unique to itself, and by expressing it, it's fulfilling its purpose. And so a lot of his like aesthetic theory comes from that. And so it's It is important to a lot of his poetry. But anyway, he also had a lot of internal struggle about how to handle wanting to be a poet and wanting to be an artist, but also his religious vocation and how that all fit in. He was probably gay, and he died deeply depressed in Ireland, which he hated, where he was teaching.
All right.
Yeah.
Nice. Yes, he was gay and a masochist, and a lot of what he did was to ward those desires off, including becoming a Jesuit priest.
Great solution. Yeah.
He wrote poetry before he became a priest. His family was totally against it. Before he became a Jesuit, his family was totally against his conversion, but he insisted. And his first great poem is a poem called The Wreck of the Deutschland, which is about some nuns who drowned, as you know, from having read it for today. He was very much a naturalist, again, a little bit like Rossetti that way, which is just he noticed details. Details really matter to him. They didn't get blurred away in this uniform death that you get in Swinburne. He's the exact opposite. Details matter. He was a great naturalist. In his notebooks, there are long descriptions of stuff that he's seeing in nature. He learned Welsh before he went to Ireland.
Yeah.
He learned Welsh and actually wrote poetry in Welsh, which is not an easy thing to do if Welsh is not your first language. Welsh poetry has very strange rules, some of which affected his English poetry. He didn't seek to publish any of his poetry. He sent his poems to two trusted friends. One of them was Robert Bridges. He burned a lot of his poetry, but he'd already sent Bridges copies, so Bridges after he died. We're going to read some Robert Bridges later on. But Bridges, after Hopkins died, published some of those poems. He was then sent to Dublin, which he hated. He felt, as an Englishman in Ireland, he felt that everyone there was hating him. He also thought he was a really bad teacher, which I guess he was, just hated everything about it, wrote poems of despair about his experience. But he was an intense believer in God, hence his conversion. And so in some way he had to reconcile his own despair with his belief in God. That's easiest when he's not despairing, as in Pied Beauty, or one of the poems that I distributed today, which we won't have time to look at quickly, but that's okay with Hopkins. Part of what happens in Hopkins is there's a kind of just blizzard of terms, of words, of stresses that come at you. So I want to get back to that idea of stress in a minute, but let me just read this quickly, and it's okay if you're not following it all. But it's the poem that nature is a Heraclitean fire and of the comfort of the resurrection. So the word comfort is an interesting one, as you can see in the first poem on the page, Carrion Comfort. Heraclitean fire, what would that mean? Does anyone know?
Fire Heracles.
Which is, no, you mean Heracles like Hercules? No. Heraclitus.
Yeah.
So who's Heraclitus? So Heraclitus was one of the first now known Greek philosophers who wrote in aphorisms. His most famous aphorism, I think the one that's most famous now, is "You can't step into the same river twice." Is that familiar to people?
Yeah.
Why can't you? Because it's always changing. So that leads to the most famous two-word aphorism in Greek philosophy. In Greek, it's panta rei, which is everything flows. Panta as in means all, As in pantheist, God is everywhere. So panta means all or all things, and rei means flows, as in diarrhea, which is stuff flowing through you. So panta rei, everything flows. He also said a lot of these are called the pre-Socratic philosophers for obvious reasons, because they came before Socrates. The pre-Socratics tended to have different views of what the most elemental thing in the universe was. Was it air? Was it water? Was it earth? Or if you're Heraclitus, it was fire. So Heraclitus said everything was fire. Everything is made of fire. Everything is a different modality of fire. So that's what Hopkins is picking up on. If you do get interested in this, I should just tell you, there's a great podcast some of you may know called The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. Is that familiar to anyone? It's a very cool British podcast where, instead of doing philosophy's greatest hits, which is how philosophy is usually taught, as though, well, first there was Socrates, and then there was Plato, and then there was Aristotle, The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps goes through every philosopher, including every philosopher, let's say, to the West. No, I think he does Indian philosophy as well. I'm not sure he's gotten yet to doing Chinese and Japanese philosophy, but he does a whole lot of Greek philosophy, and the podcasts on Heraclitus are actually quite good. And it's something like, he's been doing it for over 10 years, and it's something like, there's something like 300 episodes already, which are 300 different philosophers, which you may not have thought that there were that many you could do, but that's why there are no gaps in what he's doing. Anyhow, one of the first podcasts is on Heraclitus, and very informative. Okay, so nature is a Heraclitean fire. Everything is fire. That is the what the poem is claiming. So what things are fire? Cloud, puffball, torn tufts, tossed pillows. What do? They flaunt forth. Then Chevy on an air-built thoroughfare, heaven roisterers in gay gangs. They throng. They glitter in marches down, rough cast down, dazzling whitewash. Wherever an elm arches, shive lights and shadow tackle and long lashes, lace, lance, and pear. So notice what he's doing as opposed to, I don't know, Swinburne, is he is pushing alliteration. There are rhymes here. Air built thoroughfare, marches, arches, and air pair, for example. But we're not noticing the rhymes so much as we're noticing the alliterations and the stresses. So the thing about Hopkins is he is the poet of stress. As he himself said, every time he can find a stress syllable, he will. Stress syllables are what he lives for. So down, rough cast. Just notice three stresses in a row. Down, dazzling, whitewash. Wherever an elm arches, shive lights and shadow tackle and long lashes, lace, lashes, lace, lance, and pear. Delightfully the bright wind boisterous, ropes, wrestles, beats earth bare of yester tempest creases. In pool and rut, peel, parches, squandering ooze to squeeze dough, crust, dust, stanches, starches, squadron masks and man marks. Treadmire toil there, foot fretted in it. Million fueled, nature's bonfire burns on, but quench her bonniest, dearest to her clearest self and spark. Man, how fast his fire dint, his mark on mind is gone. So when a man dies, how quickly he dies is what he's saying. Both are in an unfathomable, all is in an enormous, dark, drowned, oh, pity and indignation. So how is it that we die when nature is so full of power and stress? Drowned, oh, pity and indignation. Man shape that shone sheer off, disseveral, a star. Death blots black out, nor mark is any of him at all so stark, but vastness blurs and time beats level. So that's a very quick summary of Swinburne, let's say. Everything is blurred. Time beats us level. Enough! Did I say that loudly enough?
You didn't wake up the dogs.
So. Oh, all right. Enough. The resurrection, a heart's clarion. So certainty of the resurrection, the comfort of the resurrection. Enough. The resurrection, a heart's clarion. Away grief's gasping, joyless days, dejection. Across my foundering deck shone a beacon, an eternal beam. Flesh fade and mortal trash fall to the residuary worm. World's wildfire leave but ash. In a flash, at a trumpet crash, I am all at once what Christ is. Since he was what I am, because he was human. And this jack joke, poor potsherd, patch, matchwood. It's a description of being a human being. What is a human being? A jack, a joke, a poor potsherd, match, patch, matchwood, immortal diamond. Where'd that come from? Just all these solid things, the last one of which is immortal diamond, is immortal diamond. So that is the comfort of the resurrection, that all of this materiality that we are, that will be destroyed, nevertheless, there is the resurrection and is immortal diamond. So that's Hopkins pushing all the particulars of the world as just these things that stand out, that jut out, and that even if death is going to erode them all or attempt to, it's the jutting out that matters. So to go back to what Julia was saying about Hopkins's relation to scholastic philosophy, is that what, you use the term scholastic philosophy, right? So here's just a little bit of Catholic philosophy for you. People know the word Thomist, T-H-O-M-I-S-T. So that refers to St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomist philosophy is the version of philosophical understanding of the world that the Catholic Church gets from the church philosopher they consider the greatest of them all, who is St. Thomas Aquinas. You probably know people wherever you're from who went to St. Thomas Aquinas High School, because they seem to have them in like every county. So where are you from?
Dover, New Hampshire.
Okay, there's a St. Thomas Aquinas High School there. Yeah. Yes. So good, that bet worked out. Do other people know St. Thomas Aquinas High Schools?
There's one in my college town in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Yeah. All right, okay. So not bad. And La what, Wisconsin?
La Crosse.
That's why you don't like LaCroix.
It's really not.
Okay. You know, you should try pomegranate-flavored LaCroix. Don't. All right. And Aquinas is really important to Dante, and he lived in the 13th century. Dante's father probably met him, and Dante may have met him as a child. And really important to Joyce, who was against him. But the basic idea is that what Aquinas did was to take Aristotle and turn it into Catholic doctrine and Catholic theology. He's not the only one, but he's a great merger of Aristotle with Catholicism. His great book is a book called Summa Theologica. That is the summation, let's call it, of all of theology. And so the idea in Aristotle and in Thomas is that you look for what is true of everything. And one thing that's true of everything is that it has substance. That is, that there is, if you know, do people know what transubstantiation is? Mm-hmm. So what is it?
It's the idea that when you take communion, It's actually like part of what really started the Protestant Reformation. It's the idea that when you take communion and like the wafer is placed on your mouth, the moment it actually touches your tongue, it becomes the body of Christ. And the same with the wine, it becomes his blood.
Right. And the fact that it still tastes like wine and not like blood, tastes like a wafer and not like human flesh. And inevitably this brings up in my mind the thought of Butters on South Park. But that is not a problem because there's a difference between substance, which is what things are made of, and what's called accident, which is the parts of them that we perceive. And in a sense, that goes back to Heraclitus. For Heraclitus, the substance of everything is fire. But the idea, it's called transubstantiation because the substance changes even though the surface appears to be exactly the same. So you're not supposed to say, no, that's still wine, I don't believe it. Yeah, it tastes like wine, it smells like wine, it's got every attribute, is another word for accident, of wine. But the substance is no longer the substance of wine, but the substance is the blood of Christ.
And Martin Luther's problem with that was that it just sounded like BS.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yes. But then that led to a lot of other theological debates. But yes, exactly so. So Aquinas is taking that distinction of substance versus attribute from Aristotle. So there's another medieval philosopher. I don't know if you need to know the... Nah, I won't go to it. There's another medieval philosopher named Duns Scotus, who was famous for wearing a particular kind of cap. Anyone know? A dunce cap, yes, which is when he fell out of favor, you would be called a dunce because you would be as wrong as Duns Scotus was according to the Catholic religion.
So, which is not true, actually, because he ended up actually, things that he disagreed with Aquinas on ended up becoming dogma hundreds of years later. So, yeah. I don't know, I'm a Scotus defender.
Yeah, good. Although, here's what Milton said about both of them.
Okay.
He said, talking about a moment in the Faerie Queen, that he said of that moment, he's reading a moment in the Faerie Queen, and he says, this is why Spenser has this thing happen here. And then he says, Spenser, whom I dare be known to consider a better teacher than Scotus or Aquinas. So Milton rejects them both on behalf of Spenser. You should read Spenser. He's the greatest poet you've never read by far. By far. You have no idea how amazing he is.
By far, I mean by which point? Oh, by far, okay.
By far.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about by now.
No. By far, he's just fantastically great.
Not to get like too off track, but did you ever read the Spenser Private Detective?
Yes, who's named after Spenser?
Yes,
he's named after Spenser because Robert Parker had done his dissertation on Hammett and Chandler, like the fact that Chandler named his detective after Christopher Marlowe and also Philip Sidney. That's why he's Philip Marlowe. So Parker, having written this dissertation, said there is life after graduate school. You could become a best-selling mystery writer.
I love Parker.
And so he did Spenser for Hire. Plus, it's set in Boston.
Yeah, it's actually really fun to like go around Boston listening to Parker on tube.
Yeah, yeah. So Spenser for Hire, and it's spelled the right way: S P E N S E R. So at any rate, what Scotus said is, no, the crucial term is not substance, but what, you're going to love this term because it's so, it looks so different from what it is. You want to?
I don't remember, H-A-E-C-C-I-T-U-S, question mark?
Why? Yes. Hycicity.
Yes.
So you will remember from your Latin, hic, hic, hoc, right? Mm-hmm. Who is? Remember it? Hoc, 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 honk, honk, hoc. Okay. Hic, hic, hoc means this, thisness. Hicicity is thisness. It's a Latin term for thisness. That's why it's funny to call it hicicity, because it's not, oh yes, Latin abstraction, blah, blah, blah. No, it's thisness. And that is what Hopkins, which I want to say is Hopkins, but it isn't. I wish it were. Hic, hic, hoc, Hopkins, Hopkins, Hopkins. Don't take notes on that. It's just stupid. It's the thisness of things. Hence, glory be to God for dappled things. For Hopkins, it's the thisness of things. Hence, the alliteration. And hence, we'll pick up on this on Monday, but hence his concept of what he calls... Here, do we have a minute? What he calls in stress. So the term in stress is a term that Hopkins invented. And what in stress is the thisness of everything. And what he says is, God produces a world, and it's a world of objects that are stressed, the way syllables are stressed in poetry. So the word stress there is not, oh, I'm so stressed, I have a paper due tomorrow. The stress is just, boom, it's there. And why is the world full of stressed things? Because they are stressed with the grandeur and the glory and the presence of God. That is, the in stress is the projection of God's power and presence into a thing. But those things stress themselves into us. So we become aware of all the fantastic, powerful particularity of every single thing in the world. And language does that, and objects do that. They stress themselves into us. They push into us, into our minds. And you can feel how language does it with the cloud, puffball, torn tufts, tossed pillows, flaunt forth. All of that is stressing right into our minds as we hear or read it. But that's what objects in the world do as well. And that is all, glory be to God for dappled things. Every dapple is a stress. So that is the first part of Hopkins's, let's call it his poetic mode, his prosodical, the prosody that he writes in, the versification that he uses. In stress is crucial for that. And we will pick up on Monday with his related concept called sprung rhythm. So hang on to that term, sprung rhythm. And we'll pick up with this on Monday. Okay, have a good weekend, everybody.